the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and as well as being a regular host for the show for the last decade, I'm also founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, helping people with cancer to understand and benefit from integrative cancer care. My two guests today, Mags and Murray Cluley, are a couple who work together to support people facing a cancer diagnosis by sharing their own experience of cancer within short retreats at their home in the West Country. Mags, hi Murray, really delighted to welcome you both to the Yes to Life show.
Good morning, Robin, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So you two have got an extraordinary story to tell of love and of healing and of the things you've discovered through your experiences that you're now sharing with others in various ways. I want to start out by quoting someone who's been on a short retreat with you and who encourages others to open your heart and mind to an opportunity which may change your life. I wonder if you could describe in a few words what that opportunity is.
I think the biggest opportunity that I had from somebody else when I was diagnosed was hope, was being having the seed of hope planted to understand and to realize that there's other people out there, a lot of other people out there that have cured cancer, advanced cancer, by holistic methods, by not normal allopathic methods. And that's what gave me the hope, and that set me on the path to healing.
I think that's, we have been described as giving people hope. That's the biggest thing we give people, is hope that we're positive, and you know that the what they take away from the retreat is that hopefulness, and that there is an alternative way of looking at things, and it doesn't have to be all sadness and doom and gloom when you get a cancer diagnosis.
Great. All right. So I'm sure we're going to talk about hope some more during the course of the chat today. So, of course, I'm going to want to hear all the backstory, how you got here. I'd like to start way back, if I could, long before there were any thoughts of cancer around. Like, when did you first meet?
Ah, good question. We were college lovers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Met at college, basically, in Scotland. And Max is very loud, and I'm quite shy and quiet. So they say the opposites attract. So I think that was the key.
They do.
I'm very quiet now.
Love into it.
Yeah, we met. We were both doing a college course in Falkirk in Scotland, and I just met one lunchtime, and I was 15 at the time, and you were 17. So just from there, that's how it started.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. All right, so move on now. You got married?
Yeah.
In which year? When was that?
We got married in 92. And 92, yeah, it seems like a long time ago.
It is quite a long time ago. And somehow you made your way to the Middle East. You know, tell me a little bit of the filling in between.
Yeah, well,
how you got there.
I'm an aircraft engineer by trade. Did my apprenticeship with British Airways, so spent a lot of time living, working around airports. Did my apprenticeship at Heathrow, and then spent the best part of 14 years living and working around Heathrow and Gatwick. Then I had the opportunity to go to apply for a job in the Middle East. Good salary package. It seemed to be very tempting. Basically the right place at the right time. Was lucky enough to get the job. And we loved it. I think you jumped at the chance. The kids jumped at the chance. It was fantastic lifestyle for expats, privileged life. So we decided to head to the Middle East.
Mm. But you had actually, Murray had actually spent time abroad as a child with his dad being a civil engineer. So he had spent a couple of years in Dubai and Kuwait and the Caribbean and such. So he always wanted to go back. Yeah. So when he said he wanted to go and live there, and we went for our honeymoon, as part of our honeymoon, we went back out.
Okay.
And it's the first time I had seen Dubai in 1992. And I was like, yep, I'm on the plane. Just get the job. I'll be there.
Very good. And you said you and the kids, how many?
Two kids.
Boy and a girl.
Yep.
Right. Okay. And what age were they when you moved out there?
Keir was 3 and Morgan was 7.
So pretty young. Okay, then comes a bit of a shock in the Middle East, 2012, do you want to say?
Yeah, so we've been living and working there for 8 years or so. Like I say, fantastic lifestyle. And it all came crashing down when one day I passed blood in my urine, had some abdominal pain, went to the doctors. They did various scans and blood tests. But, I mean, it was pretty obvious the blood was just basically like a rusty brown colour. And he came into the waiting room basically after a couple of hours of these tests, looking solemn in that, and to say that it looked like renal cancer, kidney cancer, basically. Yeah. And they said they detected like a very large tumor on my left kidney, and that it was basically maybe only like 5% functioning, 5%. And they also mentioned that they looked like there was signs of secondary as well. So yeah, it was devastating. It was basically, it wasn't a good time. It's like your whole world comes crashing down. You know, I think what I was going through in hindsight, I was probably not in a good place anyway. So when you get the diagnosis, it's like sort of a final straw, and you do tend to think the worst. So we just decided to take it day by day after that to get advice. The advice we got straight away, more or less, from the urologist was to go to London, to Royal Marsden, to have a radical nephrectomy, to have the kidney removed, and then to worry about any secondary disease.
So you had to move back to the UK then?
It was just for the operation, yeah.
Oh, you just came over for the operation rather than moving as a family.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I'm lucky enough to get a good insurance package and all that, so that the work did take care of the medical side of things and the time off and tickets and all that, yeah.
Great. Okay, so, but that was only the beginning of the story. As you say, they already detected secondaries, so that wasn't going to finish it for you, was it? So what next?
Well then, Murray, we came back 3 months later for another scan at the Royal Marsden, and the surgeon had said that they thought it could be dust in the lungs, but obviously, you know, you're not thinking about that when it's secondary at the time because you're thinking about the kidney. But they said the dust was in fact lesions, and there was a hilar lymph node as well that was that had got bigger, that would just block off Murray's airway eventually, and he had offered palliative care at that time. And we said, okay, so that's going to cure it. And then he was like, oh, no, we're not talking about curing this. This is just palliative. And then we left there and thought, okay, let's go back to Dubai. And we'll just, because I know these oncologists, the surgeons can be quite difficult to push the chemo and stuff on you. We said, right, let's go back to Dubai. And we'll just say, we're going to speak to the oncologist there, and then we can make a decision, and we can kind of play them off against each other so they don't hound us into doing what we didn't really want to do.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. We went back to Dubai, and that's when Murray met a colleague as well. You'd met a colleague who cured himself.
So I'd sort of basically taken the decision not to go down the palliative route. I didn't want to spend the last few months, years of my life feeling rubbish, not feeling well. And I just felt, well, just let nature take its course. And then I met a Malaysian colleague of mine who told me the story that he'd cured his stomach cancer, and he showed me all the scans and everything before and after. His cancer had gone secondary as well into his lungs, which was the big one, because you hear about, like, when it gets to your lungs, you know, it's very, very advanced. And he planted the seed of hope, and I thought, right, if he can do it, I could do it. I always remember him saying that the oncologist, he doesn't know what I'm like. He doesn't know me. So how dare he tell me that I've only got so long to live? I want to take control of that, and I can prove him wrong, you know? So, and I think that was part of my mentality as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's interesting what one interchange like that can mean to somebody, isn't it? Funnily enough, I mean, that's in scientific terms, that's considered anecdotal and not science at all. But actually, it can be very important, particularly if somebody has got the evidence to prove what they've done, you know, in which case this person did. That for you was kind of life-changing in terms of your attitude and what your intentions became. It went from dying gracefully to seeing if you could stay alive. Quite a different direction.
Definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think as well, because you're in the Middle East, you have the two kids there, Murray was aware of, you know, I don't want to leave the kids behind. I want to see them growing up. And they weren't particularly old at that time. And for me as a woman living in the Middle East, my options were very limited as well. We owned a house. And for me, it also, you know, when you get that diagnosis, everything goes through your head.
Of course.
Of the children. Murray had to get a will made to say that the children would come to me instead of going to his father and his brother.
It's for sure I look.
So it was all these connotations that living there, I was thinking I'm going to be left here and I'm just going to have to get a passport and get out. So there was lots of stuff going on at the time that just compounded the whole cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Anyway, it's interesting you were talking about being pressured to do chemo and that kind of thing. I mean, fortunately, I think in the sort of stage four scenario where they admit that what they're doing is palliative, I remember one doctor opened the whole thing up with an article in mainstream media that basically said, well, he wasn't going to spend the last few months of his life suffering with chemo. He's going to make the most of it. And that kind of let all the doctors off the hook from having to push chemo on people who, in their minds, are going to die anyway. And that was a good change, I've got to say.
Yeah.
The other thing that I was thinking when you were talking there is that the intention of the oncologist is a very important thing to establish, because it's not clear. The intention of a patient is always the same. I want to stay alive. I mean, you know, that's a given. But it's not, and you kind of easily assume the oncologist is thinking, how am I going to keep this person alive? But they might not be. They might have already said, this person's going to die, and therefore I'm going to do this. It's going to make it slightly better or change it a little bit. And that mismatch of understandings can be terrible, really, especially when you find out much later that they were never ever thinking of keeping you alive and you thought they were. They were giving you treatment with no intent to keep you alive particularly.
Yeah.
And so it's a very important thing to establish, because many people have, I know, have stumbled across this mismatch where you suddenly realize, oh my God, they're not actually trying to save my life. And it just simply wasn't clear ever. And the word palliative is not in common use. It's not a sort of thing you use a lot in normal English language. It's very specific to things like oncology. And it doesn't mean that much to people. When they say, oh, we're giving you this palliative care, they think, well, thanks very much. You know, it's like they don't know what it means. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think conversely, if I was told that there was a chance that I could live and survive if I took the chemotherapy, and I went down that route, I maybe wouldn't be here today to tell the story. I think it might be in a completely different outcome.
Maybe. It's hard to know these things. Maybe. It's hard to know. But of course, they didn't say that, and they didn't mean that either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So what happened? What did you do?
So immediately I took the advice of my friend, my colleague, and I stuck to basically a very clean, plant-based, salt-free, sugar-free, alcohol-free diet straight away. And I did that for, I even did that before the operation, just to sort of get the ball rolling. I tried to ask the urologist, the surgeon, if there'd been any improvement in the size of the tumor when he took the kidney out, and he didn't seem to give me any feedback on that at all. So anyway, I'm not sure why. So did that, did the diet for a few weeks, came back to Dubai after the operation to recover. Had a couple of months off, so that was fine. But my head wasn't in the right place. I still was worried about the whole situation.
Mm.
Living in the Middle East, I was lucky enough to work with a diverse amount of colleagues from different countries and that. A few of them are Buddhists from Sri Lanka, and they said, Mr. Murray, you should come to Sri Lanka and you should attend a Vipassana meditation course.
Okay. Was that very left field for you? Something you would never have thought of doing before? Or?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I wouldn't have thought of that myself, but no. At the same time, it did make complete sense, you know, just to try and get my head in the right place, because just to sort of calm my fears and all that, basically. Yeah. So, and that's what got the ball rolling. I think that's definitely helped me get my head in the right place and to sort of realize I could basically do victorious over cancer. But to the extent where you do the meditation and then you feel so good, it sorts a lot of things out, a lot of sort of past traumas, things come bubbling up to the surface. You release a lot of things to the extent where I probably thought, you know what, this is more psychosomatic. I don't need the diet so much. So I still stuck to mainly a plant-based diet, but it wasn't as strict as when I started. So I put this down to the fact that the cancer still remained. It stabilized, but it hadn't disappeared completely because I wasn't being strict enough with the diet.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle, and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So did you manage to get the upper hand overall in the end?
Well, yeah. So basically it came to a head where I had stomach pain. So the cancer had basically shown itself in the form of tumors in my abdomen. I went to the hospital with bad abdomen pain, and they said it was because the cancer spread and I had tumors in my abdomen. Around about the same sort of time, we were made aware of Chris Wark's Chris Beat Cancer, his Square One program. So I got some advice from that. I started to follow that, and it basically it confirmed what I had been doing, but it sort of confirmed the fact that I should be doing it a lot more strictly. So I basically juiced only fresh juice. I was juicing carrots, apples, beetroot for basically 2 weeks. Even within 3 or 4 days, the pain went. So I knew that was the answer. I knew basically if I stuck to the juicing only, then it would help. And from that day on, I thought, right, I'm gonna screw the nut and I'm gonna stick to this diet through thick and thin. I lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And then I stuck to it for a while. We went on holiday, family holiday to New Zealand. One thing we always believed in was basically enjoying ourselves and having a good time and make sure we did plenty of holidays and made plenty of memories together.
Yeah.
But as you probably are aware, and your viewers are aware, in New Zealand it's very outdoors sporty. So I was skiing with my son. We were mountain biking, walking a lot, hiking and that. And on the way back from the holiday, I started to feel a bit ill, and got back to Dubai. I felt jaundiced, just felt under the weather. My skin was becoming jaundiced. My eyes were becoming yellow, and I was losing function of my legs. My legs were very stiff, and then they wouldn't function. I couldn't stand them. I couldn't walk. Went to the doctors in the wheelchair, and they said, right, you need to get to ICU. The doctor said, I don't like what I'm seeing here. You need to get to ICU, to the hospital. So I went to hospital. They took tests, and they saw that my blood levels weren't too good. They were going in the wrong direction. So I ended up in ICU for, how long was it?
It was about a week, I think. I think it's about a week, because the first 5 days were pretty grim.
Just can I ask how long this was after your first diagnosis?
This was in 2017. So this is like 5 years.
Right.
I mean, when,
5 years later.
When Murray was doing the diet and the meditation, when the diet slipped, we were talking about 4 years where his diet slipped.
Right.
And he was doing the meditation and the supplements, and we did energy sessions together. He was trying to stay stress free. But this was over a 4 year period. And then when he wasn't well with it spread to his abdomen because he doubled over in pain and I had to take him to the hospital. And then that's when he thought, right, I'm going to stick to it. I'm going to stick to this wholly. And then the year after that, 2018, is when we went to New Zealand.
For a point of view of perspective, already you're way past your sell-by date with the stage 4 cancer that you had at the beginning, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, right. Yeah, okay, yeah. Keep going.
Yeah, so 2018, it took him to intensive care. They couldn't find out what was wrong with him, but you could see he was really not well. They asked me if it came to it, can we put him on life support? Because they couldn't give him any more oxygen because his lungs were collapsing. And I was like, well, yeah, of course, you know, I'm not going to refuse that. I was like, absolutely, you could do everything you can. And then his one kidney had left, was collapsing. When he was throwing up, it was like a black liquid, but it soon became apparent it was obviously dark blood. Your liver, obviously the jaundice, your liver was collapsing. So it wasn't looking good. But then after, we were doing lots of energy sessions, and then about 5 days in, myself and my friend, who does the same energy work as me, but 5 days in, something had changed. We did a session with him and something changed in the room and we couldn't put a finger on it. And from that day onwards, he started to get better. And we thought, right, okay. So like a day later, the oxygen came off and things started to get better. They concluded that he had rhabdomyolysis, which is a muscle breakdown, because he'd done far too much exercise on not enough calories.
Oh.
And this concluded in it had septic shock and multiple organ failure.
Yeah.
So
they also mentioned in a letter, which we didn't realise till after, so after we read it, to the follow-up letter, that I also have a gallstone. I've still got a gallstone in my gallbladder, and they think it might have been a backup of sludge or some sort of infection that might have caused it. But they're not 100% sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So completely not cancer related whatsoever.
No.
So it was just a bit of a twist there.
Yeah, yeah. So
that was.
Oncologist basically came to see me in hospital. He said, "Look, go back home, rest and recuperate, and then when you're well enough, come back and we'll do a scan just to see how the cancer, how the cancer progressing, you know." And obviously, was a bit worried about that. I thought, maybe is this been caused by the cancer? Is it because it's worse? Fearing the worst, went back for a PET scan. And
this was 3 weeks later.
3 weeks later, yeah. And then we went back to get the results of the PET scan, walked into the doctor's office, and he basically said, carry on what you're doing. It basically looks like the tumours are resolving themselves and you're going into remission. So we can believe it. It was.
I bet you are ecstatic. Yeah, it's an amazing feeling that you've actually you have that amount of control. Really, basically, that through your own efforts, you can actually reverse the process like that.
Yeah,
which everybody sees as so inevitable and just only goes in one direction, but it doesn't, does it? No. So extraordinary. Yeah, congratulations. Amazing. So we're now. I'm going to fast forward now. 7 years further on, okay? And, I just want to talk a bit now about where we are now. First thing I want to ask about, just you mentioned the healing sessions that you had. This is some form of Reiki you do, is it, Max?
Yeah, I mean, I started, when I was living in Dubai, I started doing Reiki with a woman who was teaching it out there. Eventually did my Reiki Masters, and then when she left the country, and then I went on to do a lot of shamanic work with a guy in the States, in Arizona. I did a few years with him doing stuff, courses and stuff with him. So yeah, it's Reiki based, I guess, but I mean, you could call it shamanic healing, Reiki healing.
Right.
I mean, I'm not big on a label of what it is. I just know what it right. does for people.
Right. It's very interesting. Obviously, as far as you're concerned, that kind of support played a key role at this point.
Bethel, yeah. Max was completely instrumental in my recovery, and the information I was getting from Max, I knew it wasn't coming from her. She was like almost a, how would you call it, a medium to this information. Mm. It was coming from the, I will say, the universe, and I just firmly believed that they said we can take care of it. We'll sort it. And I firmly believe that. And I think at first, your belief is very small and you don't believe it. But then gradually, the more you say it, the more you practice it, the more self-affirmations that you have, then you do believe it.
I think as well as Murray coming from an engineer's perspective, being an engineer.
Yes, I was thinking that.
Black and white.
Is kind of difficult for someone like that, and clients that have, it's difficult for them to get their head around it, that you've got something that you can't see that can help you. And, you know, I think for me, the clients that I have, the most difficult bit for them is the emotional release and going, getting rid of the trauma from their past and bringing up stuff that they just want to bury. That's for me. The people I see is the most difficult thing. They can do the diet, they can do the meditation, but unless you release the stuff that's there that you need to get rid of, then, it's going to be a difficult road.
Okay, well, there's lots of people who will agree with you on that for sure these days.
Mm.
Okay, yeah, so 7 years forward, here we are in 2025. So the banner under which you operate now is called Kick the Terminal Liver Cancer. So apart from the obvious point, the Murray was terminal in 2012, but I can now attest that 13 years later he looks decidedly as though he didn't terminate to order. In fact, he looks shockingly healthy.
Thank you.
Do you want to say something more generally about terminal diagnoses?
I think it doesn't have to be a death sentence.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I think you never give up hope until you draw that last breath. Because there's always hope there. There's always someone that can help. You just have to research it. You have to do your research, and people like yourself and your website, it opens up a lot of possibilities and opportunities for people. And you have to go with your gut. And it doesn't have to. I think cancer is a scary word to most people. And it doesn't have to be if you just educate yourself and look at what you can do and take control of it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also the again, it doesn't matter if it's terminal cancer or any cancer. To me, in hindsight, the cancer was a wake up call. It was an alarm bell, basically telling me to sort my life out, and that my body had basically gone out of balance, and I had to get that balance back, you know, slowly but surely.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list? Then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
Cappuccino, latte, Americano, flat white, macchiato. Just imagine, for less than the price of a single cup of coffee out on the high street, you could enjoy an award-winning online magazine every month with up-to-the-minute information on health and healthy lifestyle. Sounds like a good trade-off? Check out Health Triangle magazine on the UKHealthRadio.com website. Just sacrifice a single cup of coffee every month.
Let's all put health first.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, well, it seems you're comfortably settled in the sunny land of England these days. from the photos on your website, in a very nice spot. And you're offering retreats for people. You've got two lovely little cabins there. Looks like orchard and woods, several acres. Looks really nice.
Yep.
Do you want to say a bit about what you're offering people?
Yeah, I mean, we're in Somerset. We've got 3.5 acres. We've got two cabins that when people come, they come for 3 days, 2 nights. And we start with lunch. So we'll do, it's all plant-based natural foods. And they have, over the space of 3 days, they will do the five principles that we believe helped Murray, which is we'll go over the diet, the juicing, fasting as well was important. Murray does meditations, two meditations a day, sunset and sunrise. And then I'll do a healing session with them, because for me, that'll tell me what is the root cause of their trauma, and give them techniques how they can release that trauma. And then there's an exercise people do as well when they're here, there's a spiritual exercise they can do of writing things down, and we do a burning bowl ceremony. And then we go over supplements and exercise and resting and all the things that Murray did. And we've got, we are lucky, we're in 3.5 acres. We've got deer that come down that are wild. We've got orchard, as you said. There's woodland walks. It's just a lovely little spot. It's a lovely little spot.
Yeah, it's definitely conducive to peeling, isn't it? I think, yeah. But the main thing is, we just want to tell our story. We don't want to preach anything. We just want to tell them our story. We make that clear to them at the start. It's just about my journey. Their journey might be different. And the hope that they can take some key points away and practice them themselves.
Yeah. Well, great. The two things that are immediately striking me is that for a lot of people, just to go to a place like your place and get out of whatever their life normally looks like would be extraordinarily helpful. And just to give them the space to look at what's happening in their lives. And of course, your story, the thing it has built into it is reason to hope, isn't it? Which is great. So there's two very big things to offer people, along with all the practicalities as well you spoke about. That's great. Quite interested, Max, in that you spoke about your sort of healing session as such, like a diagnostic session. So you were finding out about them and what they needed. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a fair assumption. Yeah, absolutely. I've been doing this for quite a lot of years. So for me, on a spiritual level, it is like a diagnostic session, and it is getting to the root cause of what causes the disease in the first place. That's my belief. I know some people may say it's genetics or bad luck. I don't believe that. I think everyone carries baggage. Murray's no exception. Our book details the sessions I did with Murray as well. And it says, it tells about what he had to do, because you can't just have one session and go, okay, that's it. You'll be cured now. There's things that you have to work through. Murray was the same. He had to come to terms with emotions that he hadn't experienced, with things that had happened in his past that he could not so much bring it to the surface come to terms with them and put it to bed. And I do find that people have disconnected from their true self and the essence of who they really are.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Well, that's modern living for you, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's always been true to a large extent that that's common. But I think modern living in particular is just driving that. It's like rocket fuel for becoming completely disconnected. In so many ways, isolated, socially disconnected, disconnected from reality. There's just so many things going on that are taking people away from their real selves.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. That's true.
So you mentioned your book. Let's talk about your book. It's aptly named Kicking the Terminal Out of Cancer. You wrote it, Max, it says. I don't know how much Murray got in there, but anyway, you give a blow-by-blow account of the whole story of your life together. There's two particular aspects of the story I'd like to ask more about. I want to go into the healing part of it a bit more, because, that's your thing, isn't it? next, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's what I love most mm-hmm. in life is just finding out about people and whatever I can do to help them. That's my thing.
I mean, I said that when I got cured, we'd do that. We'd try to help people.
Yeah, we did say we did. Murray and I did positive affirmations when we were in Dubai and kept saying, when you get cured, it wasn't if, because you need you need the intention. You need the intention of the intent of this is what is going to happen. So it was when Murray cured himself, we were going to go and help other people, which is why we're in Somerset, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. But in this very kind of materialistic world we live in, all the practical aspects seem to be the most important things. And this is nothing to do with any of that. In terms of the amount of weight you give on the practical and the spiritual, emotional life, all the rest of it, do you think they're equally important? Do you think one is more important than the other? Or does it vary depending on who you're helping?
Very good question.
I think they're all equally important. You need to do all of it. You can't just do one over the other because Murray was doing everything apart from the diet. Well, he was doing the diet to an extent, but he was doing everything apart from the full diet. And that proved that that wasn't enough, that he had to do the diet also. So then when he brought that in as well, that is what healed him. So you need everything. But I think for me, the people I see, that the trauma and the energetic healing aspect is what they miss. That's what they miss. We have a lot of people who say, right, oh yeah, I'm doing this diet. And I know by speaking to them, it's a clean diet. I know they're going to be doing the supplements. And they think the materialistic things is the most important thing and the trauma thing is not, but it's not. It's equally as important. And for us, you need to do everything because it's a bit like you should do everything or nothing.
Yeah.
Because there's no point otherwise.
Yeah, and it's almost like the diet probably helps clear your mind and put your mind in a good place.
Very good.
To then lay the foundation to go on to the next step and to think about the traumas and the spirituality.
Well, I think, that's a very good point. You're basically describing the opposite of the disconnected view that so many people have is that actually we're not this aspect and this aspect. They're not separate bits. It's all one thing, actually, that whether we're doing the diet or looking after our mental and emotional state, it's all just us, actually. We're looking after one thing, which is us. And that is, I think, in a way, is the message of integrative medicine, is that we're a lot more than the sum of our parts. We're a whole, and all of those parts matter if we want to thrive and engage with life in the best possible way. So whether that means recovering from cancer or just having a good life, I mean, it's all the same. So, very interesting. And so on this matter of connection, you two seem to be very much an item.
I've been for a while.
It's only been about 40 years.
Don't know.
Yeah.
Knowing the difference. Different.
And science is actually telling us so much these days about the detrimental effects of isolation and the positive effects of social and intimate connection to our health, to our well-being, to our longevity. So I wonder if you could say something about love in relation to your story.
It's important, very important. We'll be honest that when I was diagnosed, we weren't going through a great time with the pressures of my work were coming out and I was bringing my work home.
Right.
And we were arguing. So that probably added to the disease as well. But I think we shouldn't realise that we had to basically nip that in the bud and we had to work together.
I'd say love is the cure for everything, and not just on a relationship, loving your partner. I mean, we're all connected. We're all connected in some way, humankind. So, and I think all you have is love, really. You know, that is the basis for everything, and it should be the basis. And I think what happens in society now is that gets lost. The whole, you know, this not being nice to people.
After mankind, fellow mankind.
Yeah, it's got lost somewhere. It's got lost, and I think we need to bring it back to that.
Well, I think there's a power in the fact that the work you're doing together, because you've obviously, you've overcome a lot of things in order to do that. I mean, you just described, a long-term relationship is not a smooth journey, is it? Let's face it. It's a lot of work, and in a way, part of the journey is going to the bottom. and then going on from there. So it says a lot, and it also adds to the picture of hope that you're trying to communicate to people, that because a lot of people are very they don't have a lot of faith in the ability for people to relate consistently and in a loving way over a long period of time, that it always runs out, or you know, their trust in that is low. And so it's an important undermining feature, if you like, for people and their faith in life generally. Mm-hmm. And you know, the relationship is a kind of an expression of a trust in life, in a way that you can actually express it in practical terms in the form that you are, I think is a great thing. And people like that, they go to the movies to watch films about it. And you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it is something that we warm to as humans immediately, unless we've had some very bad experiences or we're very untrusting, in which case we won't like seeing it. But most people will immediately enjoy the company of people who clearly like each other, like you two do, and they like each other despite the annoyances of putting the toothbrush on the wrong side of the basin or whatever, the day-to-day nitpicking things that can get in the way of a proper loving relationship.
And I think that's it. You have, it is the rough with the smooth, and it's not all plain sailing all the time, and that's not life. You know, that there has to be give and take, and we do like each other, and we're not
horrible.
We do like, I think that's a good basis, isn't it? You do like each other. We're not horrible people to anybody or each other particularly. You know, we're not horrible people. You're nice people that you like each other's company and you get on, and we've got a lot in common. Yeah. So
I think age helps as well. I think you tend to mellow out, especially with age.
Thanks.
And that, but you know, or when we were younger, we would argue and we wouldn't speak to each other for days. But
yeah, well,
days.
Of course, that's what you do.
Now we have an argument, and it's basically water off a duck's back. We move on. Yeah. We'll argue for 5 minutes, and then we'll act like nothing happened.
It's experience. With age comes experience, and yeah. We've definitely got experience.
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. Well, look, just on the back of that, I would personally, I describe what's wrong with oncology. It's got a very deep lack of love in oncology. That's the best way I can describe what's wrong with it. It's nothing to do with what they do or anything else. It's how they do it. And it's done without love. If there's love going on in an oncology ward, it's happening under the radar. People are doing it when nobody else is looking because they think they can get away with it. You know, some nurse is doing something loving, but it's not really approved. It's actually unapproved to behave lovingly. And, you know, the proper distance everybody has to keep and all that. It's just...
professionalism, yeah.
That, to me, is what's wrong with oncology. And we have a charter at the moment, which we put out, which actually describes this in detail and all the aspects that we'd like to see in oncology. Not what they do, but how they do it. And it's a big ask, but that's what's wrong. And we think it's important to call a spade and say so. And interested to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think certainly our experience from oncology is it felt very much like a production line. It was a production line of, right, he's got kidney cancer, it's spread to his lungs, it's in his abdomen, there's not any hope for him. So, but you know what? If you take this drug, it'll give you another year or so. And it was just, it was just a production line of this is what he says to everybody in our situation, and you know, just do this. He didn't care. I think neither of them didn't really care if you lived or died. I would put money on they thought you were going to die.
Yeah,
because when we in Dubai, the oncologist in Dubai, when we said at the start we're going to sort this, we're going to heal this, we're going to heal this with a change in lifestyle. And he didn't even look up from his notes. He didn't acknowledge what I had said or that we were going to try other practices to try and help Murray. All he was interested in was, no, this is what you need to do, what I'm saying. You know, he's not interested in us. And then the last day when we went in and he said that Murray was clear of cancer, but he had three tiny spots in one lung left. Everything else had gone, which has now gone. He's now had a scan since and it's not there. And then he said, okay, what did you do then? And it was like,
good for him for asking. Rather than don't ask.
He did ask, but he wasn't, I don't think he was that interested. And his follow-up report had said about everything, and then it was spontaneous remission. And perhaps, it was like it was something like perhaps or maybe Murray's lifestyle had contributed to it.
Spontaneous remission, the great cop out, eh?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Anyway, look, we're out of time. Great chat. Loved talking to you both. And I encourage anyone who's facing a cancer diagnosis, feeling overwhelmed, lost, hopeless, depressed, if you like anything in what you heard today, why not check out their website, which is
www.kicktheterminaloutofcancer.co.uk.
There you go.
Everything's on there, books on there, all the information on the retreat, the cabins, information how Murray helped himself, all on there.
Link to Facebook page, link to Instagram.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
What a pleasure to speak to two such lovely people and to hear about their efforts to provide others with access to the kind of support that was so valuable to them. I want to remind you that the next big event in the Yes to Life calendar is our autumn conference. This is on the 27th of September. It's an in-person event in central London, and it shares the title What's Really Working with our online conference held in the spring earlier this year. It'll be showcasing some of the best UK practitioners working in the integrative oncology space, as well as a broad range of exhibitors offering resources and services to those with cancer. If you'd like to find out more or to book a place, then visit the charity website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and look under the events menu. Do make a note to listen again next week when I'll be back with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.